So I think it's timely and useful looking at the conditions of our world and our community at large, our community of Nashville, our community of Tennessee, the southern community, the northern community, the nation, the world. I think it's useful and helpful to start to look at this idea of engaged Buddhism. In a way, sometimes the Buddha was referred to as the rebel saint. Oftentimes, I reflect on actually how similar our current state, really on the global scale, is to at the time of the Buddha during his decision to go forth into homelessness and to seek awakening. And so tonight I want to talk about Lizzie and I would like to talk about the topic of separateness, social suffering, and compassionate action. Milan Kundera writes, "Speed, the demon of speed, is often associated with forgetting and with avoidance, and slowness with memory and confronting. We move slowly when we want to listen to ourselves. We move slowly when we want to listen to others and the world around us. We move slowly when we want to accept ourselves. The rush of contemporary life overwhelms us in our ability to observe, to hear, to stop, and to wonder. Society and its speed wants to blow out the tiny flame of memory." The radical stance that the Buddha took was one of turning towards the suffering of his life, of his world. Being willing to look at the conditions that, and the causes of human suffering. How does this manifest? First, usually we look at internally, mental anguish. Do we see this? The anxiety of the mind, the stress of the mind, the fears, the insecurities, the vulnerability of life, birth, aging, sickness, death, and the reality that we're sensitive to loss, we're sensitive to change, and we're sensitive. And that there's pain that's naturally associated with being born into a heart and a mind and a body that feels with the world and the change in the world. This is the first task that the Buddha proposed in his path to awakening, is to learn to be honest about and willing to embrace our suffering, being willing to turn our attention towards what's getting in the way of our ease and our well-being. Sometimes in some of the classical texts, they were translated a long time ago, we would look a lot at this idea as ignorance, human ignorance, which sounds a little belittling to me. But if I look at that, I actually kind of like looking at that in the sense of ignorance, of our tendency to not always be so honest about the ways that suffering's generated, not only internally, but interpersonally in our relationships with our loved ones or work enemies or neutral acquaintances. And then in our larger communities, and just being willing to even inquire and to ask some questions about the world that we live in. The Buddha said that nothing causes more suffering than clinging to views and opinions. And so not so much hurrying into a stance and taking a position or taking up this, we call this sometimes self and othering, you know, and finding our stance or finding our view or our opinion to really hold tight to, but more so what he was asking is to really investigate. And through this practice of mindfulness or vipassana, the seeing clearly of looking at the mind and seeing, investigating the ways that the mind causes suffering. Looking at the ways that my speech and my actions and relationships cause and generate stress. Not falling into this, really actually, you know, we talk about going against the stream here, the stream of ignorance, of ignorance. Just the day-to-day, the one comfortable thing to the next comfortable thing, this trap that I find myself in daily. But being willing with mindfulness and with community to have some accountability to some of these systems of suffering that not only exist internally but externally. These instructions on mindfulness that were spoken for the first time 2,600 years ago, the Buddha explicitly offered that we practice mindfulness internally, externally, and both in relationship. And some of the context of really how Buddhism came to develop, there was strict and strong class structure in the region of India where the Buddha was living and all throughout the subcontinent. In a sense of spiritual life, awakening, God even, was only welcome for the upper class. This word swastika that we all know, it's actually a Sanskrit term that means the good life. And this is the idea that back in the Brahminic culture where the Buddha came from, that if you lived within your class and you fulfilled your duty, then you were living the good life. And if you did that, you maybe had the chance at being born again and again into these same roles and these same, and if you could do your role correctly, and then maybe one day through thousands and thousands of rebirths, you could be born into the caste where you actually had a chance to be with God and to awaken. And we obviously see where this idea was later taken. And so the Buddha's radical stance was that, he said, seek no external refuge. He said, everything you need is already inside of you. All you have to do is the hard work of waking up to it. Not any metaphysical waking up or awakening as an event, but as a gradual process, the hard work of asking ourselves these tough questions. How do I suffer? How do others suffer? And how can I diminish suffering? So he said, embrace, we learn to embrace and turn towards suffering. This word suffering is a little bit challenging because what it's actually attributed to is this Pali Sanskrit word dukkha. Dukkha has several meanings. It can mean like a general sense of unsatisfactoriness or turning towards our, I like sometimes even just using the word stress, our stress or distress. But etymologically, we're, one of the ways that I really like that dukkha is translated is this du akash, which means an innate sense of feeling separate from the other. So he said we want to actually turn towards this delusion that my pain and my fear and my insecurity and my vulnerability is mine. And we see this. I'm someone that has suffered a great deal with depression. And this relentless, these voices that kind of, I don't even know where they come from, but they're there of like, I've always felt this way. I'm always going to feel this way. I'm the only one that feels this way. This almost isolating sense of suffering. And so when we're unwilling to do the hard work and the messy work of confronting our own suffering and the suffering of our communities, we suffer alone. And we get stigmatize mental disorders, and we feel alone in those, and disabilities. We develop norms. We develop dominant systems of what's okay, what's normal. And so in order to wake up, in order to alleviate suffering, we need to look at the causes and conditions and actually work through the causes and conditions that create suffering. This is where sometimes we tend to have this spiritual bypass that I'm very familiar with, trying to outsmart suffering and ignore it away with meditation. Ignore it away with this having myself being wrapped up in my spiritual practice. The comparing mind, how am I doing? How am I doing? So we need to work through the causes and conditions. And this means that, as Carl Jung says, we need to become a great problem to ourselves. And this will take also bringing forth the qualities of the heart, of compassion and kindness and forgiveness, self-forgiveness, forgiveness for others. And I even think that one of the heart practices, we talk about kindness and compassion, appreciation, equanimity, those are usually the four. I think that equanimity has a piece of this, but I would almost add, I think it's a heart quality to practice patience. Maybe that's a part of compassion too. Of bringing forth that quality of almost this diligent and curious patience. Because if we're not patient, we can get this feeling of apathy, oftentimes coming from feeling overwhelmed or like we don't have a say or we can't do anything. And we forget actually how much we are doing and how much we can do. And as simple as looking at a stranger and saying hi when we normally wouldn't. Or making someone feel welcomed when we know they're feeling isolated or alone, separate from. And looking for those opportunities where we see separateness in ourselves and others to reach out and to say, no, no, you're not alone. There's an African proverb that says, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. Without accountability, we fall off the path. That's okay, we can get back on the path. But with accountability, with support, with friendship, with community, you know, with people that are willing to talk about their own vulnerability, it actually makes us feel more safe. And when you feel more safe, you feel less stress, less dukkha. I like the scientific, the physical science, physics has a definition of stress that says that stress is when an object lacks the inner resources to meet its external demands. So you can see when we feel alone and we feel separate and we feel like it's all up to us to deal with the weight of the world, we feel like we don't have the inner resources to do that because we actually don't. And so reaching out and asking for help and practicing this patience and this humility, you know, really bringing that forward as an intention and then as an action, we feel more safe. So I just want to read this quote about the Buddhist teaching on wise association, on really practicing associating with people that are curious in waking up. And he says, "If you find no one to support you on the spiritual path, walk alone. If you see a wise person who steers you away from the wrong path, follow him or her. The company of the wise is joyful, like reunion with one's family. Therefore, live among the wise who are understanding, patient, responsible, and noble. Keep their company like the moon moving among the stars." None of the Buddha's teaching was meant to be conceptual, although we need concepts to know where we're at. Sometimes the Dharma, the Buddha's teaching, the Dharma, is talked about as the Dharma map. So it's always good to have a map. We can notice, we can kind of orient and look around and see, okay, these are the supports I have. I know that landmark, I know this road. But we all have to do the work of walking the terrain, and we have to do the work of exploring the territory. So, just offer this for your own reflection, and want to offer Lizzie some time to talk about taking care of ourselves, especially in the present day and our current conditions. You know, what are some of these skills, or what are some of these tools that we can use to really take good care of ourselves? Compassionate action. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me, everyone. So I'm a therapist here in town, and I have a specialty in trauma and stress, and so that's part of why I'm here, is to just simply offer information that you can weave together with your practice, and to offer information that might add to the map, so that in times like these it's hard to know where we are in time and space, right? I know for me, it's like, what's going on, right? I mean, that's the feeling. And because I believe in the importance of acknowledgement, right? And remaining awake and vigilant in the face of something that might feel overwhelming and scary. And sometimes that'll take a group effort, right? Like, I myself didn't want to go to work today. That was my experience. When I woke up, I was crying, and I didn't want to go to work. So, reached out to Andrew, said, let's do something, right? Let's do something. Let's engage in action that's mindful and thoughtful and hopeful. So either silently, or you can raise your hand if you feel comfortable. How many people have had trouble today or this evening sitting? Good. Okay, good. That's good. That's part of what I wanted to talk about. So I think that what happened yesterday was kind of traumatic. No matter what side you're on, it doesn't matter, right? So that's not what this discussion is about. But if you're aware and you're watching, there's a lot of feelings. There's a lot of sensation. There's a lot of fear. Perceptions are askew, right? And there's an intensity in the air, right? And so this was not, there's a lot of shock. So acknowledging that we might be experiencing a collective trauma of some sort, you know, is really important. And then understanding what happens to me when I am experiencing something like that, and how does my mindfulness practice intersect with trauma? What does that mean, right? We kind of do this every time we sit. We're kind of touching these topics every time we sit, but this is the mushroom cloud of it, right? And so it can feel disorienting. So if you're having trouble sitting today, that's good. That means that your brain is working properly. it means that the parts of us that are meant to keep us safe are doing their job. Because in the face of something so extreme, we're not wired to get out our pillow and sit. That's not the time. We're supposed to run or fight or, right? We're supposed to do these survival things. So it's a good thing. And I want to acknowledge that. And I don't think, you know, I want to offer the excuse. You can have that excuse for a while, right? That your sitting is going to be disrupted. And that's good. And so be with that. What does that look like for you? And it might be different, right? So my disruption is in my head. Your disruption might be in your body, right? Your disruption might be somewhere else, right? Or you might not feel anything at all. That's okay too, right? So these are all the similar experiences of how we respond to such a great amount of stress. And I believe, so this is, when I teach with Andrew, I'm always nervous because I don't have the Dharma dictionary like he does, right? But from what I remember in my practice, there is instruction that we are supposed to stabilize before we practice mindfulness through certain principles, right, of good action, meaning like the sila, right,
mm-hmm.
is like the moral code.
Showing it, yes.
Okay, good. Ding! Yeah. Meaning, like, if you go out and you pillage and rape and do all this stuff, you're probably going to have a hard time sitting, right? And so correct your behavior, and then you'll have an easier time sitting, yes? And so today, for me, what this translates to is my Facebook. So don't get on my Facebook and type, and then try to sit, because I'm going to feel activated. And I'm probably not engaging in behavior that's conducive to my practice here, right? I'm doing what's natural and normal, but it's maybe not in line with what I'm trying to do. It's not aligned with what I'm trying to do here. And so it can make my sit difficult. So there is an invitation to, like, don't worry about your mindfulness practice if you can't correct your behavior, right? Fix your behavior first. Or focus on your behavior. Try to restrain or try to find a healthy distraction. And then attune to what's going on inside. I also want to talk about what might be going on inside for some might be too overwhelming to sit with as well. For example, I teach at Belmont, and this morning I had some students that were not okay. Based on history, I assume, right? We all have a history. So whatever's happening today is touching in each of us our little clothesline of all the, you know, you imagine a clothesline with photos pinned to it of your memories of things that weren't okay for you in your life. And when you add another photo, it jingles the whole line, right? All those memories kind of come up. And for some of us, they're all going to come to the surface and demand attention, and that's going to be overwhelming, right? That's not something to sit with. I'm not sure, I've never checked, but I don't think the Buddha would probably ask you to do that. But no, that's not the intention. So if that's the experience as well, if you're trying to sit, and it's not only that you're disturbed, but you're overwhelmed past a great capacity, know that that's normal too, and that it should pass. It will pass. Most likely it will pass, right? Post-traumatic stress is healthy and normal. We should all be having it. That's like when you almost fall down the stairs and you feel the electricity go through your body, like, woo, right? That's the post-traumatic stress. That's healthy and normal. We want that. Good. You're alive. Things are working. It only turns into the disorder when we have trouble getting it to go away. So it should go away. But if it's too much right now, don't sit. You don't have to sit. Does this make sense? And I know for some of us, for myself especially, I really enjoy the spiritual bypass a lot. because I'm a good little human and I like to avoid feeling the icky stuff. So I'm going to try to think my way out of sitting with the uncomfortable feelings. I'm going to try to find a way around that. And personally, for me, that'll really turn on the activist in me, right? If I'm really supercharged about my activism immediately following some event, chances are I'm just trying to avoid my own feelings, okay? Because I don't really know enough right now to make any conscious decisions about what I should be doing. So that's that spiritual bypass. And in order to engage in a thoughtful, contemplative action, we need to be stabilized ourselves first through our practice. That can take time and patience. So I wanted to share a couple of stories as well to kind of tie these ideas together. And offer some perspective, because another thing that happens with trauma is that we literally start to operate out of a different part of our brain that has a development of about a six-year-old. because you don't need to be able to do calculus in the face of a threat, okay? You need to be able to run or fight or freeze. You don't need to do much else. But as we walk through our day, if we're only at that developmental place, if we're only at using that portion of our brain, that's how our relationships suffer. That's when our practice really suffers, right? This is when we say to ourselves, I don't know why I just said that. Well, because it wasn't you that said that. It was like your six-year-old self, or I call it the monkey brain, right? As we share it with primates. So if we're really activated like this and we're living out of that part of the brain, we have to soothe and calm down to bring the rest of the brain back online. And this is what we're doing here all the time. This is what the Buddha found out 2,500 years ago, but he didn't know about the hypothalamus, right? I mean, so he wasn't using that type of language, but that's what he was teaching us how to do, was to soothe these overactive, more primitive parts of our brain, and to utilize the higher functioning, more executive parts of our brain that have the capacity for abstract reasoning and thought. But we have to put an effort into doing that. It typically doesn't just happen without a little bit of attention and care to it. And for those of us with history of trauma, or for those of us that I also want to acknowledge our different experience, right? So everyone's experiencing this event from a different vantage point. So it's going to affect some of us more than it affects others. And we have to figure out how to connect and empathize in those ways. Or just understand what we don't know, right? Acknowledge what we don't know. But those of us with different experiences and different histories are going to have those brain centers activated in different ways, and it's going to be either easier or harder for us to get back online, so to speak. And our practice can help us with that. It really is like the apple cider vinegar of psychology. I mean, it fixes everything. I prescribe it. it works. But I just wanted to offer some of that information in case, this shouldn't feel like your typical day, right? This probably isn't feeling like your typical practice. And if that's the case, that's good, that's okay, that's normal. This too shall pass. This will go away, right? So just to offer some perspective, because I myself was you know, and I share this from a personal place too, right? Like, I was very emotional last night for my own reasons of personal history and my own position in this equation and whatever. And I myself got to a place where I was what we therapists call dysregulated, you know, where I was that child. I was not in the higher functioning part of my brain. God help me if a client were to call or a student or something. I mean, I wouldn't be of any use to anybody, right? Because I was just not mindful. And I reached out to my mother, of all people, for support. And she told me a story. Well, she really, my mother's a very stoic person, and she was basically like, you know, get your stuff together, and I have no compassion for you. And I was like, that's not very nice. But she said that because, and then she followed it up by saying, you should have tried surviving integration. And what she meant by that is that she and her siblings and my grandmother, her mother, share the social ideals that I have. And we tend to be on, you know, the liberal side of things. But she grew up in southern Georgia in a town with a swamp and one gas station and one church, and a very frightening place, a violent place for her. And she described to me the story of when they integrated the school there and when they brought the first African-American boy via bus to the school and how violent everything was, and how my uncle would sit with him on the bus and, like, take, you know, so that nobody would beat him up and things like that. But it was a perspective I hadn't thought of because I hadn't been positioned in that place in time and space. And her point was that things are going to get better and things are going to change. It's temporary, right? And she said, I have no compassion for you, because she said she was alone. You know, she's like, you're so connected to people. There's, like, people all around you for you to talk to about this. Why are you so upset? Right? I mean, she was just, like, totally, I mean, she said she was upset, but she was unfazed as well. And so that was bizarre for me, right? So, like, I kind of chewed on that for a little while. And it brought some clarity, and it brought a different vantage point that I didn't have before I spoke to her. Do I agree with her unempathetic delivery? No, I don't. But I'm biased because I'm talking about myself and she's my mother, so, you know. Well, the second piece of the puzzle is the work that I do day-to-day as a social worker, and part of my participation in my profession is with the political action committee for our profession. And of course, as you can imagine, a social work legislative agenda tends to be a democratic agenda, right? We're social workers. We have certain points that we're trying to push, right? And I work with a lobbyist who does this work. And for the last 8 years, we've worked with this lobbyist, or, well, probably longer. That's how long I've worked with him. But the point of the story is that his job is only effective based on the relationships that he has with people who are completely different than he. Okay, so today in class with my students, I explain to them as well that being different is not being bad, right? That we are all connected together. And I think that for me, my personal experience of what takes me out of my practice and what takes me out of my mindfulness and what takes me out of my own Buddha nature is not anything that I do, but it's things that I forget. Right? It's like a tendency for me to fall asleep to some idea that I can hold on to. And my experience yesterday was that I forgot that we were all connected and that it was, you know, I forgot that people who are very different than me can one day be my enemy and the next day can save my life. Because over the last 8 years, we've pushed a lot of legislation through the House, the Tennessee General Assembly, that's not been what you would think would roll through the Tennessee General Assembly. But it has. Not based on Democrats, you know. Based on relationships. Mindful relationships. And staying in the here and now, in the moment. And not falling into sensationalism. And not falling into fear. And I think the tough part for those of us that are here, because I particularly wanted to come here because of you, because of who comes here. Because the people that come here make a conscious decision that you want to live with your hearts open. Like, that's why, I mean, you walk through the door with the intention of, I want, maybe you don't know that, I shouldn't have told you, right? But you want to live with your heart open, and sometimes that's a really difficult job to do. Especially for those of us, I'm one, you know, I told you a little bit about my mom, who we weren't really trained, like, how do you do that in a world like this? It can be, like, scary to do that. It can be harmful to do that sometimes, right? And how do we do that? We do that together. And we do engage in activity when we get okay, right? We do engage in activity, whether that's your demeanor in the store with the clerk and the people around you, you know, those small, tiny, micro actions, or whether you decide to become really activated politically, you know, based on whatever your values are, big or small, you'll eventually become activated to make change, to affect your environment in a way that you feel is in line with your open heart. And you won't do that alone. But experiencing some of the suffering can be the challenge as well. So if we do have an open heart, then you're feeling what other people are feeling. And that's really extreme right now. No matter what side you're on, again, that's not what this discussion is about. No matter where you stand, if your heart is open, you're feeling some gnarly stuff right now. Yeah? And that's okay. Our practice asks us to learn how to get big enough to be with that. And I don't know the format, but I did want to throw it out there to you right now and all of you because you're listening, to have time for question and answer or discussion or to start that togetherness now. Like, this is a community.